I'm sorry if I've disappointed any of you. I was planning to talk on the subject of the reactions of animals and birds. I have been, as some of you know, publishing in Flying Saucer Review a catalogue of these cases. But I've been away for a while lately, and I've been sick on and off with various things. And I found that I really hadn't done the homework on it that I should have done. And I came to the conclusion that what I had to present tonight would be very boring. It is really a rather boring subject. It's a boring catalogue so far. Case after case in which animals or birds are frightened, and that's all there is to it. So I thought that perhaps with your permission, I might talk about something else, which I hope isn't too far out. I think might be of interest to you. So I decided that I'd talk about teleportation, or ITF, as our friend Ivan Sanderson likes to call it, instantaneous transfer. Now, you may remember, some of you, that I spoke here about 5 years ago about some cases of apparent teleportation, and that was subsequently written up in an article which appeared in Flying Saucer Review. The first of those cases was a long time ago, in 1593, allegedly, when a Spanish soldier was said to have flipped mysteriously from Manila in the Philippine Islands and turned up many thousands of miles away in Mexico. And then there were other recent cases, like the man carried from Bahia Blanca to Salta in Argentina in 1959. There was a Japanese case of a vanishing car and occupants in 1963. And finally, in 1968, there was the case of the Argentine couple who were reported to have been taken in their car from the highway at Chascomús, south of Buenos Aires, and set down on a lonely road in Mexico. Again, Mexico. It's all very, very strange. This curious concentration on Mexico. Now, I'm sure that in the next few months, you'll be hearing quite a lot more about this question of teleportation, because, like it or not, there have been a great many new cases. And mostly from South America, but I recently heard of one that happened in this country. And I think, therefore, that time has come for us to talk about it again and to try to examine whether this is, as some of us think, the same type of thing, or in any way linked to the type of thing that is alleged to have occurred in the realms of what we call psychic phenomena. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is a number of cases. There is nothing about UFOs in them at all. They're classic cases. They all happened long before 1947, long before the development of the present situation as regards what we call UFOs or flying saucers or whatever label you prefer. If you look into it, you'll find that there are a very large number of cases of this type on record. There are quite a lot in the Bible, if you collect them. There is, for example, the case of St. Philip. We're told that St. Philip was suddenly snatched up at Gaza while doing some baptizing there and was transferred in the twinkling of an eye to Azotus, a place 30 miles away. But the main cases that I want to talk to you about tonight are in the field of 19th century reports, especially in the literature of the last 30 years of the last century and the first two decades of this century. And some of these cases really make the mind boggle. Many of them were collected together and published some years ago by an old friend of mine, New York Days, the Hungarian investigator and writer, Dr. Nándor Fodor. And if you're interested, you will find some of them in his Encyclopedia of Psychic Science, from which some of these cases will be quoted. Now, the case to... I'll start with the one which I think caps all cases and stops all the clocks. This is the very well authenticated and very well known case of Mrs. Guppy. A wonderful name, I think. I always knew that there were little fishes in tropical tanks called guppies, but I never realized before there was actually a human being called Guppy. Now, Mrs. Guppy was a medium, whatever a medium is, in London, way back in the 1870s. And it seems that in 1871, a gentleman named Hearn, also a medium, whatever a medium is, was attending a theatre in London. And at the same time that evening, there was a seance going on in a house at Hackney. And the sitters were all there, sitting in the dark, as they do, when suddenly this man, Frank Hearn, turned up there among them all, right in the middle of them. The astonished participants turned up the gas and surveyed the scene and then settled down again to the seance in the darkened room with Mr. Hearn taking part. And then, I think, very obligingly, Mr. Hearn's overcoat and hat and umbrella proceeded to arrive. Evidently, the spirits did not think it quite right that a man about town should appear without his proper gear. And when you look around today, you might think that this sort of thing could be extended and with great profit. Now, we come to the night of June the 3rd, 1871. There were two mediums present on this occasion, one of them named Williams, and the other was this same Frank Hearn. And they were having a seance in Williams' house, which was at 61 Lamb's Conduit Street in North London. Now, this is one of the best attested of all these ITF cases, because there were in the room no less than eight people with two mediums, and this turned out to be a sort of return match, because at a certain moment in the evening, one of the sitters suggested that Mrs. Guppy be brought there from wherever she happened to be at that moment. Now, Mrs. Guppy's house, I should add, was in Highbury, a little over 3 miles away from the house where Williams was taking part in the seance. Now, subsequent inquiries and investigations have shown that at the moment in question, Mrs. Guppy was sitting quietly at home beside the fire, doing her household accounts. And with her in the room, there was her companion, a lady named Miss Nayland. And Mr. Guppy, for there was a Mr. Guppy, you'll be very relieved to know, he also testified later that he was in the billiard room playing billiards with some friends. And these friends corroborated his testimony. He said that he'd been up to his wife's sitting room only a few minutes before her disappearance, and he had talked to her there about some routine matter or other. Piercing all the reports together, it seems that one of the eight sitters in the room at William's house had suggested to the alleged spirit controls, or whatever it is that operates in these cases, that the spirit controls should bring something, that was the phrase, i.e. to teleport something into the room where all the windows and the door were closed and the group was sitting in complete darkness. Now, another sitter then recalled that not long before, Frank Hearn had made that somewhat unorthodox trip. One wonders, by the way, what London Transport would have to say about these goings-on if they became commonplace. They remembered what had happened to Hearn when he had gone to Mrs. Guppy's house. And this man said, jokingly, "I wish you'd bring Mrs. Guppy." Whereat another sitter hastily added, "Good gracious, I hope not. She's one of the biggest women in London." Apparently she was enormous. Well, the voice of the so-called control, alleged to be the famous Katie King, replied at once, "I will, I will, I will." And then the voice of the alleged John King, head of the so-called band of spirits, or whatever they were, was heard crying, "Keep still, can't you?" And in an instant, somebody called out, "Good God, there's something on my head." And simultaneously, there were several screams, and a vast thud was heard right in the middle of the table around which the seance was being held. A match was at once struck, and there they found Mrs. Guppy, huge and motionless, lying in a state of trance on the table amid the tightly packed participants. At first, there were fears for Mrs. Guppy's health, indeed for her life. It was thought that she might have incurred some permanent damage to her elephantine frame. She was lying with one arm shielding her eyes, and she was clad, I'm sorry to say, in a loose gown, more or less décolleté, and wearing bedroom slippers. And clutched in her hand, which hung straight down beside her, was the pen with which she'd been doing her accounts. Mrs. Guppy, a very prim soul, was greatly distressed when she came to, a few minutes afterwards, to find that strangers were viewing her in such an informal state and such informal attire. Well, after a few minutes, the redoubtable lady was sufficiently well recovered to join the party, and the seance went on. Then both Mr. Hearn and Mr. Williams were now levitated, and they too disappeared in turns in the same way. And any of you who may be feeling concerned at this moment at the thought that Mrs. Guppy might have to hail a hansom cab and return to her home in such an unseemly state will be very relieved to know that her boots and other things, her hat and outer coat and other garments, now showered down upon the table. I like to visualize those boots. I expect they were those long, tall, black ones. I remember them from my own childhood. They may be fashionable again, from all I know. I wouldn't know about these things. Tremendous, great, long, black boots with masses of buttons. Anyhow, along with them came a whole lot of flowers. Now, Mrs. Guppy was indeed a specialist on this, and she had Interflora completely licked. She was constantly producing heaps of flowers out of the void. Sometimes even full-size sunflowers with fresh clumps of earth clotted round the roots. Evidently, if this sort of thing caught on, then, as I say, both Interflora and London Transport would have something to say about it. Now, the whole time that had elapsed between the original suggestion that Mrs. Guppy be brought and her shuddering, juddering arrival on the table was found to be about 3 minutes. The seance concluded. Mr. Harrison, who was one of the sitters, and three other people, all went off at once to Mrs. Guppy's home with her and secured the testimony of the male Guppy and of Miss Nayland, the companion. And Miss Nayland told them that, yes, she had been sitting in the room with Mrs. Guppy, who was writing her accounts up, and looking across suddenly, Miss Nayland had discovered that Mrs. Guppy was no longer there. But she said she detected a slight haze near the ceiling, just above the spot where Mrs. G had been sitting. Now, on another similar occasion, November 2, 1873, there were 10 people present at the seance, and a man named Henderson vanished from, this time it was from Mrs. Guppy's house. The doors and windows of the room were all locked, and the 10 sitters were sitting in darkness, holding hands in a chain, when suddenly it was found that Henderson had broken the chain and vanished. Almost instantly, Mr. Henderson apparently was detected standing in the backyard of his friend Mr. Stokes at a distance of about 1.5 miles, 1.5 miles from the scene of the seance. And it seems that no less than 9 people actually observed his sudden arrival. It was a wet night, and his clothes and boots were almost completely dry. Now that, I think, is rather interesting, because we've seen a number of very strange cases in connection with UFO phenomena where this question of dryness in the rain has been noted. I think something should be done about investigating those. It seems to be another one of these odd little tie-ups. Another British psychic who vanished in the same remarkable manner was the famous William Eglinton, who on March 16, 1878, vanished from a séance in the home of a Mrs. MacDougall Gregory. There were five sitters present and two mediums, the names of the mediums being Arthur Coleman and J.W. Fletcher. Apparently somebody has suggested that the mysterious powers, calling themselves spirits, should take Mr. Coleman up through the ceiling. But, in fact, it wasn't Coleman who vanished, but Eglinton, who disappeared immediately. A violent bump was heard by all on the floor of the room above, and going up there, they found Mr. Eglinton lying there in a trance. The annals of psychic science have a fascinating series of reports from the city of San Jose in Costa Rica from the years 1907 to 1909. There was a gentleman there named Señor Buenaventura Corrales. He had four children, the eldest of them aged 18, and the others 12, 10, and 7, respectively. And these children, apparently, used to take huge delight in vanishing from locked rooms, turning up outside, and then coming back again in the same way, apparently, into the rooms. Rooms still locked, the doors still locked, the windows shut, and they would come in again. Now, when investigators questioned the four children, and by the way, I've got a fascinating case recently from Brazil where a number of children started flying about, and the police arrested them and took them off for interrogation, and one of the parents was arrested too. When the investigators questioned these children here in Costa Rica, the children said that all they knew about it was that something or somebody carried them when they disappeared, because apparently they always said they always felt pressure under the arms. The next case I've got, that was 1999. The next case is a little earlier, actually. It was in 1906 and comes from Italy. Dr. Joseph Flaponi, who was the medical officer to two popes, Pope Leo XVII and Pope Pius X, recorded the case of two boys in a family named Pansini. The boys were aged 10 and 8 years, respectively, and they were the sons of a builder at a place called Ruvo in Apulia. Now, their house, apparently, had been the scene for a number of years of quite fantastic poltergeist phenomena, with crockery being thrown about and all the usual visitations. The elder boy, who was only 7 at the time when the phenomena first began, began talking in trance, falling into trances, rather, and practicing xenoglossy, which, as you know, means that he spoke in tongues which were unknown to him. He spoke French and Greek and Latin. Now, speaking in tongues is another phenomenon which is not only mentioned in the Bible, as you know, but is quite current in the world today. I have seen it myself at some religious meetings of the Pentecostals and certain other groups who are not Christian in denomination. And some of you may have seen recently a TV program in which a minister talked about it. He was a great believer in it and felt that this was something very, very important. I must say that the cases that I've seen didn't seem to me to be very important, and I'm not certain that they were really languages. They struck me as being gibberish. But there do appear to be cases on record where recognizable languages have been spoken which were not, definitely not known to the speaker. Now, the two boys, the two Pansini boys, were constantly being teleported. On one occasion, they went 9 miles from Rufo to Molfetta. And then another time, they found themselves at sea, near a place called Barletta, on board a ship. They apparently hugely enjoyed all these trips, but their poor parents were terrified. And their mother, a very pious woman, consulted Bishop Berardi, the Bishop of Bitonto, and asked him to call at the house, which he did. And just as she was telling the bishop of her fears that all this was the work of the devil himself, both the boys suddenly vanished from the room, despite the fact that she'd taken precautions to lock all the doors and windows for the interview. In another report, the same Dr. Joseph Lapponi said that he had another case of two more boys who were known as the Flying Brothers of Bari, who travelled 45 kilometres in 15 minutes on one occasion. Another writer, whom many of you must have read, a well-known writer of the 19th century and investigator, was Dr. Franz Hartmann. And he reports a similar case which happened to a personal friend of his, a doctor, he quotes him only as Dr. Z, who was living in Florence. And apparently Dr. Z was mysteriously carried a distance of 100 kilometers from Livorno to Florence in 15 minutes, and then deposited with the usual thud in a closed room. I've got a reference here to some similar cases, next cases, from Iceland in or around 1919, which were the subject of a report by Professor Haraldur Nielsen. And then, coming on a bit further, till 1930, the next case that I selected was one which Harry Price, the well-known British investigator, published. It concerned a Hindu boy named Damodar Ketkar of Pune. And this boy was persecuted by poltergeists and was transported and carried about in the usual fashion in India, particularly apparently in April 1928. One of the witnesses was a European lady named Miss Cohn. She was sitting writing a letter when suddenly she looked up and beheld this boy who seemed to be just hanging there in front of her. She said he looked quite alert and conscious, but he looked very surprised. And he said, "I have just come from Karjat." The report doesn't actually say how many miles away that was. She said the posture, the position in which the boy was hanging there in the air, was very remarkable, because he was definitely suspended in the air, definitely not touching the ground, and both his arms were hanging limply at his sides. His feet were definitely, she said, not on the floor. In fact, she said, he was precisely in the sort of posture in which a person is held when gripped round the waist and is being carried. Now, as you know, those of you who read these reports in the Flying Saucer Review, a lot of these recent cases that I mentioned have been associated, we haven't got any proof yet, although there's going to be one, I think, where the proof will be definite. But on the whole, we've got no definite proof that these cases are connected with UFOs. I say there's one exception because there is one case from Brazil now where a vehicle was actually taken up with the occupants quite conscious, and they saw it happening, and they saw the kind of clamps which came down from the UFO and fitted on the top of the car. And for some odd reason, I don't know if it was a different faction, different sort of creatures doing this, but the businessmen in the car, I think there were four of them, this was in southern Brazil, somewhere near Santa Catarina, and of course it happened at night, they were carried along quite a way and quite conscious, and they weren't harmed in any way, but they had the fright of their lives. and they were put down again on the same road. And they then saw the UFO make a pass at another vehicle, which was coming along, which was a loaded lorry. I should say, by the way, that in their case, the UFO had first stopped their engine, the usual thing. They saw it actually make a pass at the lorry and stop the engine at that. And I don't think they saw any more. They didn't wait to see. They just stepped on the accelerator and went. But some of the reports that are coming in from those countries really are quite extraordinary. Going back to these type of cases that I've selected to talk about tonight, because they are definitely not cases in which we have any reason to... There's nothing of what we call a UFO involved. The next case I've got is from Brazil. And it was investigated by a very well-known English investigator of these matters named F.J. Dingwall, a very critical, balanced man whose writing, as many of you may know. And he published this case in Psychic Research for July 1930. Now, the man involved was a medium, whatever a medium may be. He's a Brazilian, and his name was Carlos Mirabelli. And he was standing with some friends on the railway station in the town of Luz, in the state of Sao Paulo. And they were about to take the train to go to Santos. Shortly before the train's scheduled departure, they suddenly discovered that Mirabelli had vanished, to their general astonishment. 15 minutes later, it was ascertained by telephone that he was 90 kilometers away from there, in the town of São Vicente. And a witness was able to testify that he had actually encountered him in São Vicente no more than 2 minutes after he had vanished in the railway station at Luz. Now, my last case today is an occurrence which happened in Italy in 1928. And it really is a humdinger. It is very well authenticated. And the man who investigated it and wrote it all up was a great Italian psychic researcher, whose name many of you must know, Professor Ernesto Bozzano, whose books are classics on these matters. 10 people witnessed this case, and Bozzano reported it in the journal Luce e Ombra for September-October 1928. Now, I remember about 10 years ago, a very interesting Italian UFO report, this was, which I translated. It was about a sighting by a flying enthusiast, a pilot, a nobleman bearing a very ancient title, the Marquis Scotto. Now, the case I'm going to describe now, taken from Bozzano's account, happened not to him, but to his father, the Marquis Centurioni Scotto, belonging to one of the oldest families of the Italian nobility, former Italian MP, and holder of many titles, including that of Prince of the Holy Roman Empire. And the astonishing event took place in his own castle at Millesimo. Now, it seems that the Marquis had, in 1926, lost one of his sons in an aircraft crash. And grief-stricken, he did what many people do. He took up spiritualism in the hope of finding comfort. And he was amazed to find that he himself was the possessor of paranormal and very remarkable powers. And I'll quote now from Professor Bozzano's account. On July 29, 1928, in the course of a séance, at which the Marquis was himself the medium, the Marquis suddenly exclaimed in a frightened voice, I can no longer feel my legs. A gramophone was playing at the time, as you know is often done in these sort of meetings. The gramophone was stopped. And there was an interval of death-like silence. Then the sitters addressed the medium and got no answer. And then they felt about for him in the dark and they found that his seat was empty. So they turned on the red light and they found that he was not in the room. The room was quite empty. The door was still securely locked with a key on the inside. Now, they searched all the rooms in the castle without success. 2.5 hours later, seems to be an extraordinary long time before they thought of this, they decided that Mrs. Gwendolyn Kelly Hack, an American writer who was a member of their party and herself was known to have to lay claim to psychic gifts of some kind, it was suggested that Mrs. Hack should endeavour herself, by means of automatic writing, to contact her own spirit guide, as it's called, and find out what had happened to the missing gentleman. Well, at first her hand wouldn't only write these words. Do not be anxious. We are watching and guarding. The medium is asleep. Then, after several more attempts, her hand finally wrote these words. Go to the right, then outside, wall and gate, he is lying, hay, hay, on soft place. Well, the place indicated by this message seemed to be a granary in the stable yard of the castle. Now, the great entrance door of the granary was locked. The key was not in the door. So they ran back to the castle to get the key, and then, entering the granary, they found a small door in front of them, and this too was locked, and the key in the keyhole on the outside. They opened it with the greatest caution, and there, lying in the most profound sleep on a heap of hay and oats, was His Excellency the Marquis Centurione Scott. Now, when he came to, he told them that he had already recovered consciousness on one occasion while in there, while lying there in the stable. And finding himself in such surroundings, he had promptly decided that he must have gone out of his mind and had burst into tears. Because, of course, although he'd been having odd things happen to him, he never had a thing like this occur. Now, in a very strange manner, the authenticity of this affair in the castle was confirmed not very long afterwards by a message received from the spirits, as they say, at a seance in New York by the medium George Valentine, who, so far as I recall, was an Englishman. Now, it's important to emphasize that nothing whatever had been revealed or published yet about this affair of the vanishing Marquis. So certainly nobody in New York could possibly have known about it. It was only published, I think, a month or so later. But this message received by George Valentine in New York City referred specifically to the experiment at Millesimo Castle, and the communicating entity, whatever it, or whoever it was, said that he had himself helped to teleport the Marquis into the granary. As I say, it was not until a month later that the first account of the teleportation was published. Discussing his extraordinary experience, the Marquis said this: at that instant, I could not feel my legs anymore, and I had the impression that I was going into a trance. I asked Fabienne for her hand, Fabienne being the woman who was sitting beside him, and I seized her hand to reassure myself. And after taking her hand, I felt something descending over my brain and over my face, and I felt myself light, light, very light, but of such lightness. And then I felt as though I was fainting, and then I recall nothing more, nothing, nothing, nothing. Here, then, are just a few of the weird things which, it seems, really have happened to people. I think it's no good for us to just sit down and dismiss these stories, as 99% of folk do, because if human evidence and testimony are of any value at all, some of these cases seem to be very well supported. If we have any sense of curiosity, and I think most people haven't any, I think we ought to look very carefully at all these weird things, and at all these weird things that are happening now in connection with alleged flying saucers, alleged UFOs. And we must try to learn whether there's any link between the two sets of phenomena. I'm not saying that there are. I think we ought to try to find out. One can think of a great many individual elements which seem to be present in both of them. And Ivor Mackay has just written an excellent article in Flying Saucer Review in which he has shown, I think, very concisely and very clearly the type of the way in which these phenomena do duplicate each other in both on both sides. I think we've got to be really open-minded about it. We haven't, I don't notice that in the last 20 years the scientists have done very much towards explaining the so-called UFO phenomenon, and I'm quite certain, on the basis of what has been said to me by a number of quite important astronomers in the last year or two, that we aren't going to explain the thing simply on the basis of our science as it is now. It seems to me that we've got to expand our science, and we've probably got to go back more than half a century and start looking at some of the things that those very brilliant men, Cambridge men, most of them, were not ashamed to look at in the early 80s when the Society for Psychical Research was founded. Many very brilliant men in the early years were engaged in this sort of work, and I think it's a very tragic thing for our species. It may be a fatal thing for our species that for some reason or other the subject no longer continued to attract men of the same caliber. It may have been because, as you know, a psychic phenomenon is not repeatable to order. It's not repeatable in a laboratory. And I dare say another thing was that people found that these things went on and on and on, and they never seemed to be getting anywhere. But the fact remains that, on the whole, our species turned, our best minds, our best brains turned away from the subject and refused to look at it. And you have a state of affairs like the present, where, as Professor Sir Alistair Hardy, who is a very eminent Oxford biologist, name must be known to many of you, and he was president of the Society for Psychical Research last year, and I heard him say on one occasion, in a lecture he gave, that he felt that our species had probably had very little time, and that the one thing that might save us would be an attempt to look at this other side of things, to find out more about our real nature and our real powers and faculties, and where we fit in the scheme of things, and what other forms of intelligence there are about we don't know anything about yet. Now, he was not just anybody. He was he's a very eminent biologist. And I think that time has come when, I'm certain that the time has come, when we have got to bring all these things into our field of survey and try to look at it all in a balanced way. John Keel, whose writings many of you probably know, journalist, professional journalist living in America, who's written many articles in Flying Saucer Review, has just published a book which I think is going to be very important. It's got one of the three or four important books on our subject, called UFOs, Trojan Horse, or Trojan Horse, UFOs, Trojan Horse. And the blurb is a bit, perhaps a bit ambitious, because it claims that he really has told us where they're from and what they're doing. I think that's going a bit too far on the part of the publishers, but I think we've gone a long way. And what the conclusion that Keel comes to is that there is no evidence whatever that these things are extraterrestrial, a view in which I agree 100%. And I'm very glad to find that more and more astronomers who are interested in UFOs also have that view, that there is no scientific evidence, no astronomical evidence, no evidence whatever yet that these things are coming from out there. We've always got to leave the door open for the arrival of things from out there, because after all, we've landed on the moon ourselves. It's true, the moon isn't very far. It's scarcely outside the Earth's biosphere, really. But we have been there. Men of our species have been there. And we must, therefore, leave all these options open and accept that as a valid possibility, just like the other one. But Keel says that over the years, that the great weakness of our species has been that all our thinking about these things has been compartmentalized. You've had the orthodox religionists looking at their little side, their little picture. Rather like the famous story, you know, of the men in India. A whole lot of men in India were clustered around, blind men were clustered around an elephant. And they were all trying to describe this creature. Of course, they all had different bits of it that they were handling and touching. So the accounts they gave were very partial and were completely misleading. And it would only be by putting them all together that you could arrive at an idea of what an elephant was like. Now, Keel says that this is what we've been doing, that our orthodox religionists have had one view of things, that your spiritualists, for example, have had another. Your psychic researchers, because they are not the same as spiritualists, in the sense that I hope I offend nobody by saying this, that the psychic researchers are a great deal more critical than the spiritualists are. I think that I have seen many very remarkable psychic phenomena myself in several parts of the world, in the Far East and in Australia and in America, and here I have seen quite remarkable materializations, for example. They are considered to be rather rare now compared with earlier times. And, of course, you've got ufologists like ourselves, another group of people who are looking at one small part of the elephant. And you have the scientists, the few scientists who are willing to look at the elephant at all. There aren't many of them yet, but their numbers are increasing. And they're looking at some part of the animal. And it'll only be by putting all these pictures together, looking at the totality, that we shall have any hope whatever of finding out what it's all about. Keel thinks that whatever it is, that he shares my view now, he didn't share it originally, but he now shares my view that there is a good element involved in it as well as a bad. If you like to talk in terms of goodies and baddies or angels and devils, I'll go along with you on that. There's some pretty nasty things about it, it's certain. There are probably many more the nasties about than the others. And this may be because we actually are in their bailiwick. I think it's very likely. It might be that some kind of operation is going on, as a result of which we may have the possibility or the hope of contacting something else. This might be what lies behind the whole thing. But one thing seems to be certain, and that is that something is already impinging on man's consciousness in a very extraordinary way, is producing the most fantastic disturbances in the human psyche. These terrible waves of violence which are sweeping the earth at the moment have made many people think the irrationality of it, the drive towards drugs, the maniacal killings, the mass murders of people, perpetrated by people, mass murders of other fellow men, I know that some countries, the authorities are very worried about this. There was a case, for example, in Moscow not very long ago, where a scientist, I think he was a scientist working in the field of plasma research, was pushed under a train on the metro line, and by a woman, and was of course killed. And when the authorities arrested her, she said that spacemen told her to do it. I saw a case in one of the papers last week. I haven't remembered to cut it out yet. Of a similar case where somebody said that spacemen had told him to murder somebody. And I think there is a very real danger, a very real possibility, that a large proportion of our species are already possessed. I think I've mentioned this to you before at an earlier meeting. There's a very remarkable man living today in Indonesia. He was here last week, named Muhammad Subuh, whom I've known now since 1957, since he first came to England. And what happened to him in 1924 was certainly very strange, very extraordinary. And although we don't know the full details of it, and we probably wouldn't understand them if we were told, it does look to me as if they are connected with this question we're talking about. He was walking in the open air in Java, his home country, in 1924, in the summer, and suddenly a great ball of light appeared in the sky above him. He said that this ball of light was much brighter than the sun at noonday, and it descended on him and entered him at the top of the skull. As you know, this is one of the chakrams, one of the centers that are specified in Indian occultism, the Ramananda, I think it's called, Hong Wong, the Chinese call it, the yellow temple. And this light entered into him, and apparently his whole body became filled with light. He began to vibrate in the most astonishing manner. And he was a very religious man, a Muslim, of course, but a Sufi. And he wasn't afraid, of course, to die, and he was already in a state of submission to God. And being a Sufi, he walked home and said to his wife, "Get my bed ready, I'm going to die." And he lay down and actually didn't die. Some very extraordinary things happened to him. They went on for about 1,000 days and nights. And in the course of it, this man underwent an internal change of his nature. Now, this man has transmitted to many others in many countries, including this country, that which entered into him that night. I think that on its showing, that it's whatever it was, is from an on high, is benevolent, that it's good. And he says that a very large proportion of the human race have got nothing, no human qualities in them whatsoever. That our species has been totally taken over from below. And that this operation, this extraordinary thing which Subud, as it's called, this movement which he's launched in the world. Subud is a concentrated telescope word from three Sanskrit words, Sushila Buddhi Dharma. Very difficult to translate, but more or less indicating the idea of right conduct in right society, in right relationship with God and with man. He says that this is aimed at purifying the state of man and changing the condition in which we find ourselves. I think that his experience is probably really a UFO experience. Nobody that I know of has yet said so, except in Mexico, where a book has recently been written about him, in which the view has been expressed that it is a manifestation of the angelic side, if you like, of the angelic powers that are above man. Just as many of these other things, I'm sure that many of these teleportations and poltergeist phenomena and so on are certainly demonic. I've come to the conclusion that a very large proportion of the so-called UFO phenomenon is demonic. And I think that it's a subject that only very pretty balanced people should delve into too deeply. It's certainly not a thing for teenagers or for neurotic folk, for folk who are easily frightened. I think, too, that it's a very dangerous thing to give too much of your attention to it. I think it's important to have other hobbies and other work in life, to be actively engaged in normal activities. Be interested in this if you like, but try not to get sucked into it, because I've seen cases of people who have been sucked into it, and in a way it's had a very bad effect on them. There is something in it that's pernicious. There is also something in it that is very fine, that comes from very high above man. I'm certain of that. And I think that what we've got to do now is to try to find some yardstick, I don't know how we're going to do it, of knowing which is which, how a man can draw closer to that which is on the right side, which is beneficial for him, and how he can know the other. And it was said of old that by their fruits you shall know them, and I suppose this is the only way. But even there one's got to be careful. I recently wrote an article about a number of cases where people have been paranormally healed as a result, apparently, of flying saucers. The thought struck me afterwards that even there, how do you know? These people have been helped. They've had illness cured and wounds healed, but how do you know that this isn't something which is deceiving, which is out to get to win men by an apparent show of magic, of benevolent magic? How do we know that the real ultimate aim is also benevolent? I think that our position is very difficult, that our species is in a very difficult, very tricky situation. And it's going to be awfully hard for us to come through. We may not come through the next few years. You know that some of you may have read the last book that H.G. Wells wrote. It's not in print now. I don't think the publishers like to bring it. It's such a depressing book. It's called Mind at the End of Its Tether. As you know, H.G. Wells was a completely materialistic man, a man with a very wonderful imagination, largely a self-taught man. And there's no doubt, I think, that he had certain limitations in the sense that he had come to the end of his life. This was during the last war. He was sick, and he was getting on in years. And he saw no outlook for man, no hope for man at all, no way out. And of course, he didn't know about the A-bomb. It hadn't been let off yet. And the book he wrote was called Mind at the End of Its Tether. It's only 50 pages long. And it's a most depressing thing to read. I don't share that pessimism at all, because I think there are other possibilities open to man that H.G. Wells didn't know about. But obviously, if H.G. Wells thought that the future of our species as seen from 1942 or 3, when he wrote that book, was grim, well, what is it like now? And Wells' thesis was this, that in order to survive with his technology as he has it now, man somehow or other has got to, overnight as it were, he's got to change, he's stopped being what he is, he's got to be something quite different. That we could have survived all right with primitive technology, as our ancestors did for centuries, but what you can't do is to survive very long with the technology that we've got now. And he didn't see how that change could be operated in man so suddenly. I don't see how it can be changed, operated either. But it may be that some extraordinary mutation in man is being prepared now. And what I've just been talking to you about Mohammed Sabu, may relate to that. If the powers that are above intend our species to survive, of course we shall. But I'm quite certain that we're going to see some very, very extraordinary happenings in the next few decades. I think that's really all I have to say about this. How are we for time?
You're all right.
Right.